This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our headlines. The Kremlin repeats its previous stance on the use of nuclear weapons, saying such arms will only be used if Russia is faced with an existential threat. Pakistani opposition supporters rally in Islamabad as parliament prepares for a no-confidence vote against embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan. Also ahead, Canada's Indigenous people meeting Pope Francis in the Vatican demand an apology for the abuse and death of children in church-run residential schools. Thank you for joining us. The Kremlin spokesman says Russia will only resort to nuclear weapons if its very existence is threatened.
But any outcome of the operation, of course, is not a reason for usage of a nuclear weapon. We have a security concept that very clearly states that only when there is a threat for existence of the state in our country, we can use and we will actually use nuclear weapons to eliminate the threat for the existence of our country.
Dmitry Peskov said not any scenario when the conflict with Ukraine will be the grounds for using a nuclear weapon. President Vladimir Putin last month ordered Russia's nuclear forces to be on high alert. The country has approximately 6,000 nuclear warheads, the largest stockpile in the world. Peskov also said Russia is convinced that NATO is a machine of confrontation and not cooperation and security. He noted that Moscow does not accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The tribunal has opened an investigation into possible war crimes in Ukraine, but its prosecutor says Russia hasn't responded to his request for contributions. We have spoken to political commentator Scott Bennett to get his opinion. He believes the odds of Russia using nuclear weapons are very low.
Well, I don't think there's any chance of Russia using nuclear weapons in an offensive capacity. It is making the declaration that it will not tolerate any attacks upon it, be it in the form of conventional weapons, nuclear weapons, or, as we've recently discovered, biological and chemical weapons. So I think Russia is recognizing that it is doubling down on its economic war against NATO and the United States for its declarations of war by demanding oil be produced in rubles and sold on that monetary system. Of course, this is being challenged by Europe. So This is a Russian positioning itself for defense, but I don't think there's any real danger. There is almost a laughable hypocrisy in NATO and the United Nations and the World Criminal Court trying to charge Russia with war crimes, because as we're seeing every day, the evidence of war crimes is coming out that the Biden administration and members of the United States government have been involved in funding war crimes in the form of biological and chemical weapons.
Russia says direct talks between President Vladimir Putin and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky would be counterproductive. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said President Putin has never ruled out meeting his Ukrainian counterpart, but he believes it is fundamentally important to be well prepared for that matter. Elsewhere, Lavrov said Russia is preparing visa restrictions for citizens coming from unfriendly countries. This amid arrangements for the resumption of peace talks between Russian and Ukrainian delegations in Turkey later this week. Meanwhile, Russia's Security Council chief has said Moscow is not after a transition in Ukraine's government. The official said Western suggestions in that regard were, quote, inaccurate. The UN chief says the solution to the Russia-Ukraine conflict is political and not humanitarian, adding that the global body is seeking a ceasefire between the two neighbors. Antonio Guterres hoped the UN humanitarian chief would travel to both Moscow and Kyiv as soon as possible to explore the grounds for a humanitarian ceasefire. Over a month of Russian attacks on Ukraine has taken a heavy toll on civilian lives and infrastructure. Ukrainian officials say almost 5,000 people have been killed in the southern city of Mariupol alone since Russian forces laid siege to it. Kyiv says the war has so far costed close to $565 billion in terms of damage to infrastructure, lost economic growth, and other factors. Ukraine's officials also say they have proof Russian forces have used banned cluster bombs in the two southern regions of Odessa and Kherson. Moscow has already denied such allegations. Our correspondent Johnny Miller was in Ukraine last week to cover the conflict with Russia, but he cut his trip short and is now in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. He says the security situation inside Ukraine is too dangerous for journalists critical of the government or the NATO alliance.
But I recognize that the security situation inside Ukraine was too dangerous for certain journalists. A few days ago, the Ukrainian government banned most opposition parties in the country. They banned most media in the country, except for their one central channel and some foreign reporters. But in Ukraine right now, there's a feeling of anybody who reports in any way against or critical of the Ukrainian government or critical of NATO, then they can be seriously under threat. My own position on the conflict, I'm against Russia's invasion, but also very critical of NATO's involvement, of their pushing into the east, of them sending arms to Ukraine. Also have some criticism of certain elements within the Ukrainian army, Azov battalion and the ultra-nationalists and the Nazis, an openly neo-Nazi battalion within the Ukrainian army who are doing some of the major fighting on the east. If you're inside Ukraine and you want to cover that story or criticize those kind of stories, then you're under serious threat. And indeed, even if you voice the opinion that in some way NATO can be in part blamed for this crisis, indeed, even if you espouse the view that is being commonly understood now that Ukraine is largely a proxy war between Russia and NATO, and that Ukraine and the Ukrainian people are being very much held hostage to this proxy war, even if you espouse that very mild opinion, that's against the Ukrainian army. Certainly certain elements of the European anti-war left, like Noam Chomsky and other figures, have been documenting how NATO has been pushing into the east for many years, and Ukraine is being funded by NATO. And some people argue that NATO has in some way provoked this war by pushing NATO further and arming troops, arming the Ukrainian army. In the West, if you voice that opinion, you're told that you're a Putin apologist. Inside Ukraine, whether you're a foreigner or Ukrainian, if you voice that opinion, frankly, you could be in danger of your life.
Supporters of opposition political parties in Pakistan have staged a rally against Prime Minister Imran Khan and the capital, Islamabad.
Go!
The rally came hours after the parliament took up a no-confidence motion pushed by opposition lawmakers to remove Khan from power. The House will begin a debate on the motion on Thursday, and a vote will be held within 7 days. Khan lost a parliamentary majority with a series of defections from his Tehreek and Saf party, leaving him reliant on coalition allies to stay in power. Khan's opponents believe they have enough votes to unseat him. Pakistan is currently grappling with soaring inflation and unemployment, with accusations of corruption and mismanagement plaguing the government. Khan says a foreign-funded plot is underway to topple him. And Canada's Indigenous people meet Pope Francis in the Vatican, asking for an apology for the abuse and death of children in Catholic Church-run residential schools.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing. But the survivors of residential schools asked the pontiff for free access to church records and the institutions where children were abused. There was no apology yet from the Pope. However, Indigenous peoples expect him, to visit Canada and make an apology there. Last year, the remains of 215 children were discovered at a former boarding school in British Columbia. Hundreds more unmarked burial sites have been found since. The schools, run mostly by the Catholic Church, aim to assimilate Indigenous children between the 1830s and the 1990s. The U.S. Secretary of State says the normalization process between Israel and Arab countries cannot be a substitute for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Antony Blinken was speaking during a meeting between Israeli officials and foreign ministers from four Arab countries that have established ties with the regime. Blinken said Washington and its allies will work together to confront security challenges, including those from Iran and its regional friends. At the meeting, Israel's foreign minister Yair Lapid said the deepening alliance between Israel and some Arab states intimidates and deters Iran. Participants in the meeting were top diplomats from Egypt, which established ties with Israel in 1979, and the UAE, Morocco, and Bahrain, which established ties in 2020. Palestinians see the normalization process as a betrayal and a stab in their back.
Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause.
The normalization is in stark contrast with now-forgotten Arab consensus that there will be no relations with Tel Aviv while the Palestinian issue remains unsolved. But what were the motives for getting close to Israel, and how has it affected the Palestinian people?
The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
The haphazard evacuation of tens of thousands of people from Afghanistan last year, as U.S. troops pulled out of the country, left little time to prepare ORR facilities, which are accustomed to housing Central American children and teens. The COVID-19 pandemic created additional complications. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Melissa Sanchez and Anna Clark, writers. This article is published under the heading, Nearly 200 Children Who Fled Afghanistan Without Family Are Stuck in U.S. Custody. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. We'll be right back. In Chicago, ProPublica reported last fall on how the challenges involving Afghan children at a shelter operated by Heartland Human Care Services were exacerbated by the lack of on-site interpreters. After the story was published, lawmakers called for an investigation and Heartland received interpreters. But in the months that followed, police were called repeatedly to the facility. In January, officers arrested a 16-year-old boy accused of kicking and punching two workers. According to the police report, the boy said he was upset about being separated from his friends. In a statement, Heartland said it's not equipped to provide the mental health support some Afghan children need. Heartland is not alone in our experience of how the severe lack of access to mental health resources dramatically impacted unaccompanied Afghan youth who arrived in this country last fall, an official wrote. The official said it stopped taking in children after the challenging past few months to support frontline staff through team building and training. Heartland recently resumed operations, though, at a reduced capacity. Star Commonwealth, the emergency intake site in Albion, seemed to get off to a better start. It offered a welcoming setting with residential cottages on a lush green campus when Afghan children arrived last fall. Unlike Heartland, it had Dari and Pashto interpreters on site from the outset. But attorneys who visited children at Star raised red flags early on. The site was too restrictive, they said, and children complained about the lack of physical activity and phones to call their families. What's more, because of its status as a federal emergency intake site, Star wasn't licensed by the state. Immigration advocates have long criticized the government's use of these emergency facilities because they operate without independent state oversight. The federal government had begun leasing the campus from a nonprofit with the same name last spring in response to large numbers of Central American children crossing the border. Star later shifted focus to housing Afghan children. As the children remained long past and short stays, Star was designed to accommodate. The local sheriff's office started fielding calls about fights, runaways, and suicidal behavior. A volunteer who often visited the facility and asked not to be identified to avoid the risk of losing access to children in ORR custody said children would tell her they were crying all night long and ask for prayers to help with depression. She told her husband the shelter reminded her of a prison. Before Star shut down in early January, the sheriff's office in Callan County received referrals for at least 5 child welfare allegations in the final 3 weeks, records the story. In one case, a 16-year-old said two workers shoved and yelled at him. When interviewed by a deputy, one of the workers acknowledged yelling out of frustration but said he does not put his hands on the children. The other worker was separately suspended after being accused of kicking a boy who was praying, according to a report. Neither led to charges. In the case in which the 16-year-old said he was shoved, the Callan County Prosecutor's Office determined an assault did not take place. In the second, the child who said that he was kicked could not be located because he had been transferred elsewhere. Prosecuting agency David Gilbert, the director, said there were other troubles. Authorities responded to 3 allegations of sexual abuse or inappropriate behavior, including one from an 8-year-old boy who told a counselor that a 13-year-old boy came into his room. It's unclear who employed the workers, as Star was mostly staffed by PAE Applied Technologies, a federal contractor. A company representative declined to comment. Other workers came from a variety of federal agencies that loaned their services to ORR. A spokesperson for Star said the nonprofit did share a number of concerns with both ORR and PAE, but Star was purely serving as a landlord, she added. And the government, not the Star, is solely responsible responsible for programming and caring for children through its ORR program. The ORR official said that the agency has a zero-tolerance policy for abuse of any kind and that employees accused of abuse are immediately terminated or put on administrative leave. Facilities also send allegations to local law enforcement, Child Protective Services, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General, and the FBI. At Star and shelters around the U.S., workers said they were overwhelmed. Some expressed frustration, calling the youth spoiled for asking for more phone time and Afghan food, which over time they received. Other employees suspected their colleagues were afraid of children. One volunteer called the situation inside the shelter a pressure cooker. Workers and others at several facilities said they heard children say they had been told that if they misbehaved, they would be sent back to Afghanistan. ORR officials said any threats against children are unacceptable and employees accused of maltreatment are placed on leave until all the details of what happened are understood. Staffing shortages exacerbated tensions. In recent weeks, some Aritas administrators offered workers a $500 bonus if they picked up an extra shift, according to emails obtained by ProPublica. The depth and breadth of the need and the sudden nature of it put everybody in a really tough spot, Sam Bill, some Aritas chief executive, said, adding, "When I think of what these kids have gone through, it's shocking. They don't act out more." Last week, Samaritas paused operations at Grand Rapids shelter to hire and train staff. The decision was made by Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, which holds Samaritas grants with ORR, according to federal officials. Lutheran Immigration did not respond to requests for comment.
On behalf of myself and all of my colleagues here at Arabi English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. 19 years ago, a 23-year-old American activist, Rachel Corrie, was crushed to death by Zionist occupation forces. Today, we look back on her murder and ask, what are the lessons that the movement for the decolonization of Palestine can learn from Rachel's story? I'll be speaking to experts about this to find out more after this special report from Bianca Rahimi about Rachel Corrie's murder and the legacy she's left behind.
It is 19 years since Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old non-violent activist, was crushed to death, murdered by Zionist occupation forces using a Caterpillar bulldozer in Rafah, Gaza. But who was Rachel Corrie? Why was she in Rafah? And what has been her legacy?
I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children.
Rachel Corey grew up in Olympia in Washington State in the U.S., famously concerned about the problems of the world. Later inspired by the anti-war movement after 9/11, Rachel was drawn to the issue of Palestine. She arrived in Gaza in 2003. She was murdered in Rafah, defending Palestinian homes from demolition, with her comrades from the International Solidarity Movement, a Palestinian-led activist group dedicated to non-violent, direct action against Zionist forces in the occupied West Bank.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying.
She gave a filmed interview 2 days before she was killed. 4 eyewitnesses contradicted Zionist military lies that Rachel's was an accidental death. Still, no one was brought to justice even after her parents brought legal action in the US and in Palestine. The last case ended in 2015 with the Supreme Court rejecting the claim for damages in the amount of $1. Rachel was murdered 3 days before the Western invasion of Iraq on the 19th of March 2003. Less than a month later, British ISM member Tom Herndl was shot in the head by a Zionist sniper while trying to protect Palestinian children from Zionist fire. Herndl's murder brought to the end a period of violent assaults on ISM members, which started in April 2002, resulting in 2 deaths and severe injuries for 3 other ISM members. None of the victims got full justice for the crimes committed against them. But Rachel's death galvanized resistance to ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Tributes flowed in from Palestine and around the world. She became an icon of resistance to Zionist ethnic cleansing. Her writings were turned into a play and published in full. The MV Rachel Corey was named in her honor and intended to join the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, but was delayed by mechanical problems possibly caused by sabotage. Eventually, it set sail for Gaza, where it was illegally boarded by Zionist forces in international waters in June 2010. Rachel's parents set up the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice and continue to campaign in support of BDS and Palestinian rights. But what has been the long-term impact? House demolitions have continued, indeed increased, since 2003, according to the United Nations. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions estimates that about 52,000 Palestinian homes were demolished in the Nakba and another 56,500 in the territories occupied since 1967. More than 1 million Palestinians have been made homeless as a result of the ongoing crimes against humanity. Today, Palestinians are even forced to demolish their own homes or suffer retribution from the military. But today, the resistance to home demolitions and ongoing ethnic cleansing is picking up pace. The Palestinian people resist the occupier daily, and worldwide revulsion against Zionist crimes continues to grow. We are closer now to the decolonization of Palestine than we have ever been since 2003. And Rachel's sacrifice is one of so many that have got us to this point.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. He's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined down the line today from Amsterdam by Evelien Lubbers. Evelien is an independent investigator and one of the founders of Spinwatch. She's also co-founded the Undercover Research Group, and this organisation examines corporate and state spying against activist movements. Her book on corporate state and spies is titled Secret Maneuvers in the Dark, Corporate and Police Spying on Activists. Welcome to the show. David, I wonder if I could start with you. I mean, that was an incredibly moving story about Rachel. I wonder how you would describe her legacy.
Well, she became an icon, didn't she, of resistance, of non-violent resistance against the Zionists. And that galvanised a lot of opposition. You know, as you saw with the naming of the MV Rachel Corey after her and the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, that was all part of the same kind of process of taking protest to the Zionist regime. But of course, the difficulty with it was that the Zionists didn't really care about nonviolent direct action. They were perfectly happy to kill and to seriously wound people who were fighting against them. So it's been a kind of it's a bittersweet legacy, isn't it? Because it did encourage a lot more activism, which has only grown since then. But at the same time, it does bring back the issue of what it is that can finally decolonize Palestine, which I think is not only nonviolent direct action.
Mm. I mean, I wonder how you would describe, you know, her impact on the campaign against Zionist settler colonialism.
Well, I think it's made it more visible. It's part of the reason it's become more visible. I mean, she was there before and was killed before, was murdered before the BDS call was put out by Palestinian civil society. And in a way, the whole BDS movement is part of that same trajectory. And we see the BDS movement going now from strength to strength. Yes, it has some reversals and setbacks, but strength to strength and much more widely known, much more widely supported all around the world than it was back in the mid-2000s. So the legacy of the movement is that the movement's much stronger, and that plays into a much greater sense, I think, in Palestine of the impending coming of actual liberation.
Yeah. I mean, Evelyn, Rachel Corrie and Tom Herndl have a long tradition of nonviolent direct action. I mean, what do you think are the lessons from these tactics?
I think it's a very good way of getting your message across, and I think they have been an example of for many people. They are doing what many of us would want to do if we weren't, you know, confined to our jobs and our home. She really went there. And of course, it's very unfortunate that she has become such an example after her death. But I do think that it's very important to continue nonviolent action, of course, in combination with boycotts and maybe sometimes with violating the law from time to time.
Yeah. I mean, David, the you know, the demolitions are continuing, aren't they? Would you suggest that that means that the, you know, the Zionist state has got the upper hand?
It has the upper hand in the sense that it's still in power, as the figures there in the film showed. You know, that's more homes have been demolished since the territories were taken to Gaza, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights were taken in 1967 than were destroyed in the Nakba itself. So this is an ongoing Nakba, which increases in intensity. And we saw last May the resistance against that in Sheikh Jarrah and in Silwan, and the way in which that has itself galvanized world public opinion. So, yes, they have state power. They occupy, they are in control. But the control that they have is becoming more tenuous as more and more people see the weakness that there is against united resistance, which is now being demonstrated in Gaza, in the West Bank and many other places.
I mean, we heard in the film, didn't we, about the fact that we're seeing some Palestinian families now being told to demolish their own homes. I mean, this is adding, obviously, insult to injury. I mean, can you say a bit more about that?
I mean, it's a particularly cruel punishment, isn't it? The people who are effectively refugees, became refugees, and then in 67, when the occupation came, they were, some of them put out of their homes again, and there's an ongoing process of trying to, especially in East Jerusalem, Judaize East Jerusalem. And people are not just evicted from their homes by the fundamentally biased legal system, but they're then required to demolish their own homes within a very short period of time, a matter of hours, or they will be charged tens of thousands of shekels as restitution to the state. I mean, it's extraordinary that they are forced into doing this. Can you imagine having to demolish your own home within 2 days by your own hand, or you would be subject to fines of tens of thousands of pounds? It's just incredible that they would do that. But that's the way in which they operate. I mean, this is something which has only happened recently, and it shows the increasing depravity, essentially, of the Zionist regime.
And it gets, of course, little to no coverage on the mainstream media either, does it? Evelyn, I wonder if we could bring you back. And I mean, you've got experience of activists challenging to the state and corporate power. I mean, what demands do you think that campaigners should be making in the current context, would you say?
Obviously that our houses are not being demolished and instead the House of the Zionists would be demolished, but that is quite obvious. I think it's very important to keep on pressing and to make sure that this is known. As you said just now, this has not been reported on much. And it's such a terrible story. I think it's very important that they get it across in the mainstream media, because it's, well, of course, it's difficult right now with the war going on in Europe now, and everybody, you know, the large audience for them, it's much nearer, and it's difficult to get into the mainstream media at present. But they should keep on trying and prevent. Yeah, it's difficult. You can imagine that they would want to take up arms, but then it would once again get into a state of full war again, and nobody wants that to happen, I guess.
Before the war in Ukraine, Evelyn, I mean, the mainstream media rarely, if ever, sort of cover these outrages in Israel, don't they? I mean, what should we be doing about that, do you think?
It's difficult. I think it has to do with how you promote your story, and maybe more use independent media and social media to get really good film footage across, because that's the way it works, and make sure that people in the West disseminate it here so that it gets the attention of journalists. That's currently the way it works, apparently.
Yes, I'm sure if more people were aware, there would be greater outrage. But if we could just pause you there for now, we'll come back for a further discussion after this report on how undercover corporate and police agents spied on the campaign to seek justice for Rachel Corrie.
The bulldozer which crushed Rachel Corrie's fragile body was manufactured by the US company Caterpillar. The long-suffering parents of Rachel Corrie sought to bring charges against Caterpillar for their role in the killing of their 23-year-old daughter. However, Caterpillar had other plans and hired the private intelligence company C2I to infiltrate the campaign and spy on Rachel's parents as they struggled for justice. C2I was founded by former helicopter pilot in the British Special Forces, Justin King. His company illegally garnered information about the Corrie's legal strategy and also posed as sympathizers in order to infiltrate the campaign. While Rachel's parents traveled to the Caterpillar offices and asked to meet the chairman, the company refused and was paying C2I to spy on the middle-aged bereaved couple. Rachel's parents even purchased shares in the company so they could have a chance of talking to the board of directors. At the same time C2I was infiltrating the Rachel Corrie campaign, it was being treated as an authority on counter-espionage by the BBC. Justin King solemnly advised the BBC that spies are very easy to find. Sadly, it isn't hard, he said. I'm told the going rate to get a cleaner to steal something for you in London is £20, said Mr. King. Simultaneous to the surveillance of the Rachel Corrie campaign, there was a long-term infiltration of her organisation, the International Solidarity Movement, by the British state in the shape of a spy cop with a fake name, Rob Harrison. Described as the perfect wallflower, Harrison insinuated himself into the ISM and was noted for always offering to drive people places in his car and rarely stating a political opinion. The undercover officer deceived the woman involved in the political campaign into a sexual relationship. It has been said that the undercover officers were permitted or encouraged to form sexual relationships with campaigners they were spying on to obtain information. What is clear is that while much of the world was horrified at the killing of Rachel Corrie and rightly demanded accountability, the British state and Caterpillar went to great lengths to protect the killers.
Evelyn, you've done some groundbreaking research, haven't you, on corporate spying. I wonder if you could tell us how a corporation like Caterpillar would go about infiltrating pro-Palestinian groups.
I think you could say in these days there's two ways of doing it. It's one, in real life, so to say, pretending to be an activist, go to a demonstration or a public event, show interest and hope you get invited to meetings. On the other hand, on the second thing is that, of course, today with online groups and online communication, it's in a way much easier to get yourself on a mailing list of supporters of Corey, for instance, get yourself into groups that have meetings online and pretend to be an activist, like C2I did in the case of Rachel Corey's parents.
I mean, I wonder whether you could say a little bit about what sort of information C2I would have gathered about the Rachel Corey campaign.
Companies and the police in general want to know, well, companies want to know what is going to happen next. In this case, C2I wanted to know about the campaign against Caterpillar. The company wanted to know what they were up to and what was going to happen so they could prepare themselves and take away the element of surprise if the campaign would sit on their doorstep all at a sudden, for instance. On the other hand, they would want to know who was involved. Names, addresses, background of people, where they lived. In this case, they found out about the online support group and the online meetings the parents of Rachel Corey were having and managed to get into it.
I wonder, David, what your take on it?
Yeah, it's a means to try and subvert and undermine activist challenges against the corporation. So the parents there, Rachel Corey's parents, you know, went through the normal way of buying the shares to try and get into the meetings to confront the company. Of course, the company wasn't at all interested in that. It was interested in subverting the campaign against them by finding out intelligence, as Evelyn has been saying, but also by what the companies do in this circumstance. They try and destabilise the organisation. They put out false information, they leak various things to try and stop the organisation having a political effect and to attain its goal. So, yeah, it's a means to try and sabotage democratic pressures on the corporation to deal with the wrongs that they've done.
Mm. Evelyn, I wonder if I could just ask you, I mean, is there any overlap between these infiltration and spying activities between the corporate sector and governments?
Yes, indeed, there is. The people that are spied on by the police secret units are usually campaign groups that aim for change, that fight for change, fight against corporations and state corruption. So undermining their campaigns is working for the agenda of the large corporations. A second factor is that the private intelligence companies like C2I often have former police officers specialized in this kind of undermining work on their boards. C2I had at least two former officers who were retired from the police at a relatively young age and then moved on to work for private corporate intelligence companies. So they brought all their knowledge and all their network. They probably have a good access to their former colleagues to get information on the people they're spying on. So it's both in personnel, in network, and in agenda.
Right. I mean, David, I mean, you know, when Caterpillar's nefarious activities were exposed, I mean, how did they react to that?
Well, what that happened in 2017, there was a leak of a cache of documents on C2I and a number of other intelligence operations. And they responded by saying nothing at all. They don't respond to those kinds of allegations. And, of course, we get nothing. So what you see is them just stonewalling, and that's a typical public relations technique. And you've got essentially the police and the corporate spy companies, as Eveline says, working together. I mean, the famous case in London of London Greenpeace, the small organisation which used to meet in a bookstore just near King's Cross Station, where they, McDonald's, who was suing them for libel, had two different sets of spies in the small meetings each time, and also there at the same time was a special branch operative. So the meetings were more or less sort of half made up of spies. Now, that kind of thing indicates that the possibility of not just of the interests that the police are defending being corporate interests, but that they're actually collaborating, these spying operations are actually collaborating. And it's deeply concerning that that would be the case. And we don't have nearly enough information and accountability about that. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the UK is that there's an ongoing public inquiry of the spy cops situation. You know, these undercover police officers didn't just spy on the Palestine Solidarity Movement, but across a whole range, thousands of groups and left-wing groups in this country over the last half century, as Eveline has been saying. And we're getting a little bit of information from that. Eveline in particular has been doing some stunning work on that. But it's really very minor compared to what we really need, which would be to stop this kind of activity altogether.
I mean, Eveline, we've heard some shocking revelations, haven't we, about intimate relations being formed between undercover agents and activists. I mean, would you say in your experience that these sort of intimate relationships are actively encouraged by the people who were controlling these agents?
I'd rather say the women were deceived into relationships, which is closer to the truth. Or at the official undercover policing inquiry, which is being held now, the officers all claim that they were not told not to do it, and it just happened. If they agree that it happened, they said there weren't any rules. On the other hand, if we compare the experience of the women, there is a pattern. There is it always the undercover officers always know the women very well. They kind of mirror what they say. They know about their tastes, about their habits. And if they eventually have to leave, they all feign some psychological crisis or some... there's very, very similar stories in their leaving. So that sort of seems to be part of a plan doing that, and they're usually using these women to improve their status within a group. You know, if there would be any suspicions, if you have a relationship with someone within the group or in the just outside the group,
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry to say, Eveline, we're absolutely out of time. But I want to thank you and David for your thoughts today. Very illuminating and interesting. Thank you, everyone. As I say, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
The answer is simple. The U.S. military establishment does not care. The Pentagon and its higher ops have continuously failed to prioritize the health and safety of military members and their families, says Liz Walters, writer, in an article published under the heading $770 billion for the U.S. military, poisoned water for military families. Stay tuned for more. Concerns from hundreds of military families living on the joint naval base Pearl Harbor Hickam in Hawaii about foul-smelling drinking water were dismissed on November 29, 2021 by Naval Commander Captain Eric Spitzer, who assured residents the water was safe to drink. Spitzer declared that he and his staff were drinking the water, so surely reports of a gasoline-like odor, cramps, and vomiting were nothing to worry about. Then, less than a week later, on December 5th, Spitzer took to Facebook to issue an apology. What had happened in the days between initial denials of water contamination and the issuing of the apology? As it turns out, the companies of nearly 1,000 military and civilian households weren't unfounded. Rather, a November 20th jet fuel spill at a fuel storage facility near the base had leaked into the water supply, rendering the tap water of 93,000 residents, both military families and civilians, hazardous to drink. Tested samples from the Red Hill water shaft, one of the three sources of water for the base, contained total petroleum hydrocarbons diesel range organic, 350 times the levels considered safe for drinking water. Tests also showed gasoline range organics at more than 66 times the safe level. In short, despite the base commander's assurance on November 28 that the water on the base was totally safe to drink, it was indeed contaminated with petroleum and jet fuel. Just 2 days later, on November 30, the state health department urged families to avoid using tap water for drinking, cooking, or oral hygiene. While Hawaii Department of Health warned residents on the base against using the water, the Navy continued to deny any danger.